It's brand new, season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone was like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing. This week, I'm talking to the one and only Ryan Seacrest.
Love the connection to people. I think at the core, what I get excited about, what gets me up in the morning, is connecting with people in an unscripted, unvarnished way. It's getting to say something to them, hear back from them, know that I'm part of the routine, and I look forward to getting on the air. I look forward to it.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
My simple solution to the problem was remove people from the scene and help them feel safer.
In response to attacks against Asian Americans, Maddie Park raised over $250,000 to donate cab rides to the Asian community.
There is so much more work to be done. We really need to come together and tackle this issue as a community.
Support the Asian community. Learn how at lovehasnolabels.com. Brought to you by Love Has No Labels and the Ad Council.
Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, what is this thing that builds our dreams yet slips away from us? I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick. Today is going to be part two of a two-part series we're doing on anti-aging technologies, the reversal of aging.
Yeah.
Can you forestall death for some number of years? Can you make your tissues seem younger again? In the last episode, we looked at some technologies and recent advances and ideas about how long it would be before it was possible for us to become younger again, to achieve true rejuvenation through science and technology. But today we want to look at some of the philosophy, you might say, or the ethics surrounding these claims.
Or the science in some cases. Yeah, we're looking at how there are some very strong voices on different sides of this issue and what they are arguing and what they are claiming the other side represents, or sides, I should say, because it's not like it's just two. It's kind of simpler to think of them as two. And in large part, we're going to be focusing on Aubrey de Grey's philosophy
versus
people who think that philosophy is, let's say, junk. There are many other words that we could use that some people would believe are relevant. And it's really an interesting way of looking at how the scientific community handles this sort of stuff. And where you fall on this issue may depend heavily on your own personal point of view, as well as just your confidence in the scientific knowledge and ability of whichever camp you find yourself, more in support of.
Right, because it's not just the science community that is talking about this kind of thing. I mean, we all talk about aging. We all think about it. We all purchase products related to it, or at least many of us do. Or I mean, at least many of us drink water and eat vegetables. That sometimes counts a little bit.
That's true. Yeah. I do buy a lot of water.
You do, yeah. And every month,
sucker.
It's nothing but coffee for Jonathan.
Well, I mean, I don't buy the water.
What, you just get it from natural water sources? What?
What?
Do you have rain barrels?
Of course I do.
Oh. Is that legal here? Am
what?
I getting you in trouble?
Shut up.
All right, so...
Sorry. Yeah, no. It's a very impassioned subject is what I'm trying to say.
Right, and it's one that gets a lot of coverage, too,
yeah.
Right? I mean, it's...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
For, I mean... Who would have thought that people want to read about ways that they could live longer or be healthier for longer spans of their life? For some reason, people seem to feel like they have a vested interest in this subject.
Yeah, so it's not just a conversation among scientists or among the general lay population, but also among the science communication media.
Yeah, and I think that's the source of some of these problems. I mean, one problem with this topic is that it inherently has the features – by this topic, I mean research into anti-aging technologies. Mm-hmm. It inherently has the features of a research program that lends itself to, first, sensational reporting, and second, something I would call skeptics fatigue, where there are some other topics like this. For example, how about an easy side effect-free solution to weight loss, whether this is a drug or a technique, a certain new diet, new food, whatever.
I would also argue that a very similar approach that doesn't have anything to do with health would be any sort of new energy or propulsion system. We've seen reported multiple times, and there is I often see that same kind of response to those as well.
Well, I'd say that's pretty different, though, because a lot of those things claim to violate the known laws of physics.
I'm not talking about perpetual motion necessarily.
Some of these articles propose to to violate the laws of physics,
yeah.
Too.
Oh, okay. Well, no, I mean, what I'd say, though, is that I'd argue, at least, there's absolutely nothing in principle that makes either of these projects, either easy side effect free weight loss or reversal of aging, impossible to accomplish in principle. I mean, there are health engineering issues. Can you engineer a drug that does this? It's entirely possible. There's a drug that makes you healthy, successful, dieting, easy. That could exist.
Joe, I want this drug. Where are you keeping these drugs?
I'll take your money in a minute. And then also a particular therapy could make your body effectively 20 years younger without causing cancer. There's no reason I can see why this wouldn't be a thing that could happen, but because these projects are hoping to provide satisfaction of deep desires people have, like, you know, be thin, be fit, be healthy, live longer.
Be more attractive.
Live
yeah.
forever. These are desires that are held widely by people who aren't very involved with science and don't read about science a whole lot. These topics tend to reward sensational journalism and overhyping of the meaningfulness of new studies. You ever notice how, like, every few months there's a new study that could mean the end of aging or could be the new solution to easy weight loss?
Well, and you know, it doesn't help that we live in the age of clickbait, where headlines are specifically engineered to try and get people to click on them and may or may not be an accurate representation of the actual information that is included after you click.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But beyond that, there are also bad people.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Oh, sure.
There are bad people out there
who want to prey on these deep desires.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you are a person with no scruples, then you could easily identify a target audience that has a very vulnerable point to aim at and use that as your means of leveraging that person so that you can make bukus of money.
This happens
all the time.
That's one of the ways that you wind up getting things like 12-day juice detoxes being advertised
yes.
to you.
Yeah.
Wait, those don't actually make you live to 900?
Not that I'm personally aware of.
But they sure...
The Methuselah cleanse.
They sure do move a lot of juice.
Yeah, I mean, you've probably seen this stuff in banner ads. One easy trick to stay skinny forever. One simple technique to become 20 years younger.
Yeah, if you tune into basic cable, either, like, before 6 a.m., you're going to see these.
Yeah, this mom created a miracle cure. Dentists hate her.
Right.
Yeah.
So these phony ads, these phony predatory ads, plus just maybe well-meaning but just not very good overhyped media representation of research in these areas, I think leads many skeptical people to be inherently reserved about these subjects, maybe more than they would be if they weren't reacting to this kind of coverage all the time, if you know what I mean. Like, I often sense in the tone of their reactions that many skeptical science writers feel compelled to downplay the importance of research in areas like aging reversal, or even the merits of the whole project of research itself, you know. And I can understand the reason for this, but also I think if a therapy does appear to show promise for reducing symptoms of aging, that's worth responsibly spreading information about.
Oh, sure. Well, and I do want to put in, like, I feel like we're being a little bit harsh on both the research end and also on the media end. And I don't think that the majority of people are trying to trick you.
Right.
I think that a lot of people who are creating these types of therapies genuinely believe, perhaps through misunderstanding of science, that what they're doing is good and can help people. And I genuinely believe that most media, I mean, I know that I've written headlines where, like, afterwards someone kind of called me on it. They were like, that's clickbaity. And I was like, oh, it is.
I mean, exactly what I was just about to say was I think a lot of the times the research is fine. Even the whole article itself is fine. But an editor put a headline on it that's like, what?
Well, there's also the issue of press releases that are written by someone who's in PR who doesn't necessarily have an actual understanding
of the
science behind it, who might be misrepresenting a scientist's work. And the scientist would never present
it that way. Exactly.
And yet the press release is what the media picks up, and the media may or may not rework that press release to any extent, which could potentially make it even more cloudy than what it was before.
Mm-hmm.
And you get to this level where what is being communicated to the public may not reflect reality. Again, not through any kind of malicious intent to misinform, but rather through just a human failing, which happens.
Yeah.
So I think along these lines, we kind of touched on this in the last episode, but I think, Joe, you had a proposal for us.
Oh, yeah. The easiest
a blood
way,
pact, if you will.
The easiest way to bring down the temperature of these whole conversations is to never again use the phrase fountain of youth for anything related to science.
Yes.
It's all now just spigot of infancy.
Spigot
of health.
Okay. I'm going to go with a teenage wasteland.
Okay.
Okay.
Visiting the teenage wasteland.
Slightly
more confusing message, but I understand.
Well, okay. we should transition to talking about there is definitely a camp of thinkers out there who are not fond of anti-aging research for various reasons. They might think that this is not actually a fruitful avenue of research, or they might have philosophical or ethical objections to the project.
And this was something that if we had been doing this podcast 15 years ago, this conversation would probably focus almost entirely on the burgeoning field of stem cell research.
Yeah.
Because back then, it was a very, and it's still in some ways, it was a very controversial subject. It's less so now because we found other means of accessing stem cells. Also, there's a greater understanding of how stem cell harvesting happens in the first place,
mm-hmm.
where that's not as big an issue as it once was. However, there's still other things that come into play when people start objecting to this sort of research. And sometimes it's not even that they're objecting to the research. They're objecting to the way it's being framed in such a way that it seems like the research is trying to justify claims that have already been made, as opposed to research to find out if a hypothesis is true. It's more like this is research to and we're going to cherry pick all the data that seems to support this premise that we have set forward.
Mm-hmm.
So part of the issue here, and we talked about this in our last episode, it's a big, big problem, is that we don't have an agreement on what actually causes the process of aging,
mm-hmm.
Or that there is something so simple as to say this is what causes aging. It may be multiple factors that are all kind of happening at generally the same time in our life. And so since we don't have that agreement, we don't have the scientific understanding of that, it makes it very difficult to have a meaningful conversation if you're coming at this from two different points, because it may be that one camp is really focused on one aspect of aging and another camp is focused on another aspect of aging. Perhaps they're both right individually, but that the overall picture is larger and incorporates both of them.
The more that I've been researching this topic over the past week or so, I honestly think that none of the party lines that I've heard about aging could possibly be totally right or totally wrong. It's just so ludicrously complicated, and there's so many factors.
Yeah, exactly. So here's some examples. We've got, and we talked a little bit about this in our last episode too. You have the genetic hypothesis of aging, which talks about the genetic code that gives our cells instructions on how to behave and what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes the instructions that could lead to an organism's death by just extreme age. That could be, that's where the secret is. You have to get that in the genetic code. You have to identify that and rewrite it. So we know that cellular death, apoptosis, that has something to do with the genetic code, that the biological clock is a thing with cellular death.
Mm-hmm.
It is less clear on
senescence leading to apoptosis.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Senescence being the halt of cellular division, and then followed by apoptosis, which is cellular death. That's clear. It's less clear on an organism scale if, you know, what factor genetics plays. But it's an important little point to make. And then over on the pro-anti-aging side, so we have the anti-anti-aging and then the pro-anti-aging, you have people like Aubrey de Grey, who argues that aging is really the result of accumulated cellular damage.
Mm-hmm.
So he's really looking at kind of, some would argue, a step beyond whatever the root cause of aging is. This is the effect of it that then causes other problems, health problems.
I don't know if he's updated his ideas since then, but I remember the last time I researched de Grey, he had 7 points, right?
Yes.
He said there are essentially 7 things that happen that cause aging, and if you can fix these 7 problems, you have stopped aging.
Right. And genetic therapies might play a part in treating the causes of aging in this sort of view, but it's not necessarily thought of as the ultimate stop. It may be that you find a treatment that stops the damage, the cellular damage, or removes the cellular damage, or repairs the cellular damage, and that in itself becomes the anti-aging treatment. So in other words, you might even have a treatment that doesn't address the root cause. It just addresses the symptom at a speed that is sufficient to keep you from going down that particular route of aging. Which would be the spigot of health approach, I assume.
Spigot of health.
Now, those are not the only two hypotheses that attempt to explain the aging process. There are lots of them, but those are two big ones. And that's a big part of where the problem lies, right?
What about the hypothesis that it's just that you've been left out in the sun too long?
the raison d'etre?
Yeah. Oh, no.
I saw the opportunity and I took it. But anyway, yeah, this is where you get these proponents of these different camps who they might be extremely knowledgeable about their particular discipline, their particular area of research. And because of that knowledge and because of that expertise and because of the time they have spent in there, they feel that that is the most promising or most legitimate way to define aging. And the other person is completely off base, whereas that other person is feeling exactly the same way.
Right. Well, and especially when you get into the type of science communicators, you know, not just researchers, but science communicators like Aubrey de Grey, who are personalities unto themselves.
Yes.
You get into an area where it's definitely easier and it might be more profitable to say, yes, this thing is definitely the answer and that other guy is wrong.
Yeah. And that other guy is a very polite way of putting it, because like I said, when you start researching this and you start looking into even the academic papers, there's a level of animosity that is just barely disguised by civil discourse.
Oh, yeah. I sort of feed on it, actually.
You know, one thing that's interesting to me is that makes me wonder if that level of color in the disagreement is mm-hmm. evidence that this involves the violation of a taboo, like that mm-hmm. it's not just that people are disagreeing about how to do something or about whether a certain avenue of research is fruitful, but about whether people are having their sort of base instincts offended.
Maybe, I think, and it's entirely...
Not can we do it, but should we do it?
Yeah.
What shall we become if we do it?
I'm sure that's, well, there are certainly people who question research into anti-aging who fall into that particular line of thinking, right? The ones who say that is unnatural and therefore it is not right.
Yeah.
You should not do that. So there are people who feel that way. I don't know that that's the underlying cause for a lot of like the doctors and scientists who disagree with de Grey's approach. It may fall closer to the line of, I think of people who have, I hate using this example, but it's the one that comes to mind, anti-vaxxers.
Yeah.
Where you have doctors who are, they've seen the benefits of vaccinations. They know the risks that are involved, and they are very small compared to the massive benefit that vaccinations provide. But you have a vocal group of people who have very strong feelings about this, somewhat based on at least one person's claim that it's a scientific attack against vaccination, saying that I have proof here that these things are bad. I think that some of Aubrey de Grey's critics, they probably wouldn't go so far as to say he's on that level, right? But that Aubrey de Grey is, at least in part, kind of almost like a carnival barker, like getting a lot of attention and a lot of excitement around this thing, which, by the way, leads to lots of money.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we're talking about investment to fund the research that Aubrey de Grey does.
Yeah.
And that, I think, gives a lot of people a bad taste in their mouth, and that fuels this
skeptical
kind of
fatigue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the case of MIT's technology review, a $20,000 worth of bad taste in their mouth, actually.
Yeah,
back in 2005, after Aubrey de Grey's TED Talk came out, I believe, was when this happened.
Yeah, this is crazy. So when we're talking about animosity, so MIT's technology review, they ran a piece about the claims that Aubrey de Grey was making after this TED Talk. And it prompted a ton of reader response that they said was spirited and lively and led to them devising a competition. And in that competition, MIT put up $10,000 and Aubrey de Grey put up the other $10,000, a $20,000 prize to any molecular biologist who could prove that de Grey and the SENS Research Foundation, which de Grey founded, was, quote, so wrong that it was unworthy of learned debate, end
Ooh.
Quote. And SENS, by the way, stands for Strategies for Engineered Negligible Senescence. I think we mentioned that in our previous episode,
yeah.
But just in case you were wondering.
Mm-hmm.
So it was essentially saying, we will pay you $20,000 if you can write up a piece that proves that the SENS argument, that their approach is so far into the realm of fantasy that it cannot be considered scientifically valid, and we shouldn't even, like perpetual motion, we shouldn't even bother talking about it.
Yeah.
So they got some judges that included biologists and computer scientists, actually. It's interesting if you look at the list of judges. And they received 5 submissions to evaluate, but out of those 5, only 3 actually met the terms of the challenge. So down to 3. And then at that point, de Grey was allowed to read each of the challenges, mm-hmm. to write a rebuttal. And then the people who wrote those pieces were able to read de Grey's rebuttal and respond to it. That entire piece would be taken into account when the judges were reading and reviewing the information.
Okay.
So in the end, was a stalemate, essentially. The judges said that none of the 3 submissions that actually met the requirements proved that the SENS approach was fundamentally flawed. But they also said that de Grey failed to defend SENS properly and that his ideas were largely fanciful. So in other words, no one came out of this looking great. Although, to be fair, they actually said that some of the pieces that were submitted were very well written. They just didn't succeed in convincing anyone that the SENS approach was, beyond
proving
the scope
beyond
of
a reasonable doubt.
Yeah. So Some of the judges expressed personal doubts that sense is a valid approach, but granted that without scientific evidence to prove or disprove the hypotheses that sense represents, it's impossible to say that for certain. And they use the term, quote, sensational a lot to describe the sense agenda, which I think it works. It's sensational.
Oh.
The judges did award $10,000. This came straight from MIT. They didn't touch DeGray's money. So the $10,000 that MIT put up went to one submission, which they said, the judges said, was particularly well-written but didn't actually prove that sense was beyond scientific merit. That piece was written by a collection of scholars with Dr. Preston W. Estep III as the chief author. The piece is available to read for free online. I recommend reading it. It is entertaining. The group argued that the sense approach fit the definition of pseudoscience, which is, in scientific terms, a sick burn. So, in that piece, Estep et al. Wrote that these objections, they listed objections earlier. They actually listed a long, I think like 20-item long list of things to identify whether this claim was pseudoscientific or not. And the first three are what they were focusing on. Those three objections highlight the fact that human aging is not well understood, and any prospective therapy or cure must be regarded as pure speculation. This is, in fact, the crux of this list, and any claim of a cure for human aging prior to evidence of therapeutic efficacy or prior to a scientifically supported mechanistic model of human aging must be pseudoscience.
Ooh.
Which is pretty harsh words, but in a way you can understand exactly where they're coming from. They're saying if you don't understand the cause of a problem, you can't hope to solve the problem. You can address the effects of the problem, but you're not solving the problem. And DeGray, they were arguing, is making a case for solving a problem. And
right.
that's where we're having an issue, because what he's claiming, in our view, is impossible at this stage of our understanding. They objected to DeGray's seven pathologies, claiming that they are at least partially arbitrary, and that DeGray purposefully excluded some pathologies unscientifically. So in other words, he was identifying these seven keys to aging, but they said there are more that DeGray, for reasons we don't understand, chose not to include. They don't fall into one of the other categories he had identified, and he does not address why he chose not to look into these others, so therefore this isn't scientific at all. They said that sense amounts to little more than, quote, a collection of prospective therapies, some simple and mundane, for example, exercise, and some best described as fantasy, end quote.
Ooh.
Yeah. So not the only time that DeGray and his work would be criticized. It happened again in 2009.
Mm-hmm.
I read this paper as well. It's a paper titled Science Fact and the Sense Agenda. Now that, I would argue, already has some loaded language.
Agenda.
The word agenda suggests that, to me anyway, to me there
Nobody ever says agenda in a positive way.
The word agenda has an agenda.
Yeah. There's an implication there that there is a purposeful, to me it implies that they think they're purposefully misleading folks.
People use it to describe what they think of as a nefarious political faction opposed to them.
Right. It's similar to objections to the term conspiracy theory, because by calling it a conspiracy theory, you're already kind of degrading it to.
Right. Yeah. Because
that could be a perfectly apt description of a thing, though, if you have a theory about how parties conspired to do something.
Well, under those circumstances, I think it's accepted. But if you're talking about a conspiracy theory when it's in fact just a fringe theory, the fringe theory is the preferred term.
Okay.
Way. Yeah.
I have a couple of
fringe
theories.
This.
They all involve costuming.
This 2009 paper?
No, sorry. Yes. The Science Fact and the Sense Agenda was published in the National Institute of Health's Library of Medicine. And a group of researchers and doctors posted an objection to the anti-aging camps, again, focusing primarily on DeGray and Sens. So the general consensus in the group was that DeGray was oversimplifying the causes of aging, and that his proposed solutions had never been shown to extend the lifespan of any organism, let alone a human. DeGray, by the way, responded to this and said, yup.
Oh.
But essentially was saying that that doesn't mean that it won't ever be shown to be efficacious. It's just not that way yet. They didn't go so far as to say we'd never find ways to counteract aging. Rather, they argued that de Grey's approach was incredibly optimistic, perhaps in the realm of pure fantasy, if you might be sensing a theme here, and that actual scientific evidence is needed to support any of the claims he was making. They did assert that it is unrealistic to believe that we will find an approach within our lifetimes to reverse the process of aging. Specifically, the paper reads, quote, "The idea that a research program organized around the SENS agenda will not only retard aging but also reverse it, creating young people from old ones, and do so within our lifetime is so far from plausible that it commands no respect at all within the informed scientific community," end quote. So essentially, they were arguing that MIT's $20,000 should probably go to them because
so this was 2009. Yeah. I wonder what these same authors would think now. I mean, part of the issue here is that they're directing their critique at SENS specifically, yes. But then so this is partially like the model de Grey has of, yes, approaching the aging problem as an engineering problem. And yet, as we've established, there are other ways of trying to reverse or counteract aging.
Yeah, these were specifically critics of de Grey's approach and not necessarily of realms of research into aging in general.
But you can see it in the language there that there's some spillover.
Yes.
Like there's some contamination in a way of one's attitude toward a guy they specifically have a problem with to the whole project.
It definitely feels like some of them are teetering between that fine line between being a skeptic and being a denier,
mm-hmm,
right? Like, and to be fair, again, that was 2009.
Well, yeah, but the whole reason I brought this up was I wonder if these people would still say the same thing.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
given some of the research we've talked about from recent years.
And is there skepticism about that type of research coming from people other than de Grey and the SENS Institute?
Yeah, I think that de Grey is such a polarizing figure that it made it easy for certain people to make statements that perhaps are more wide than they had intended. Because I know that a lot of these doctors and scientists were in the realms of researching aging in the first place. And it's not like they don't think their work doesn't have merit or won't have some sort of applicable therapy that could be used to treat at least some part of aspect of aging.
But one thing these critics definitely do have right is that pretty much all the stuff that's out on the market today, because there is such stuff, that's all bunk. You know, the stuff people are selling today, like, yeah, become young again with this one simple pill.
Yeah, back in 2002, a group of scientists and doctors published a paper in the Journal of Gerontology titled Position Statement on Human Aging, which sounds incredibly like that's a clickable title right there. Position Statement on Human Aging. We're against
it. It's good.
So really what they were saying was that there's a growing anti-aging industry. And again, this is back in 2002. And they said it isn't based off of scientific knowledge, but rather is predatory in nature. It aims at that vulnerable spot for a lot of people, that fear of aging and dying. And the paper went so far as to say the products being sold have no scientifically demonstrated efficacy. In some cases, they may be harmful, and those selling them often misrepresent the science upon which they are based. In the position statement that follows, 52 researchers in the field of aging have collaborated to inform the public of the distinction between the pseudoscientific anti-aging industry and the genuine science of aging that has progressed rapidly in recent years.
Yeah, so I mean, that seems kind of hard to argue with even today.
Sure.
That was 2002, but I'd say still my position today would be keep a skeptical open mind about what's possible in terms of anti-aging research, but don't buy any products yet.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And it's funny because I didn't put this, I meant to put this in the notes, but I mentioned it to both of you beforehand about, I came across a study last week that was looking into the media portrayal of aging, anti-aging treatments, because just as both camps tend to yell at one another about whether the anti-aging research has any validity or if the claims are overreaching, mostly the claims are overreaching or not, that argument has spilled over to debating on how both camps are portrayed within the media. And there was a study that went through to find out, like, does the media favor the anti-aging camps more than the skeptics? Because both both groups argued that the other was being unfairly championed and that they were being demonized in the media. As it
well,
turned
ain't
out,
that always the way?
Yeah.
I mean, if you ask a liberal, the media has a conservative bias. If you ask a conservative, the media has a liberal bias.
Yeah, I've had the same thing happen on tech stuff. Like, just a technology. Like, nothing, not even a judgment on the technology. And I will have half the people argue that that, you know, you should have really gone after them on this other thing. And the other half are saying, you're being so unfair to this thing. It just goes to show that the study actually showed that as well. In fact, the study showed that there was a slight preference toward the anti-aging industry, which isn't a terrible
surprise. It's not really surprising, yeah.
But it wasn't overwhelming. It wasn't like a remarkably huge
I mean, the media, that's a bias that makes sense. The media would rather have news to report than report on something to say nothing all that interesting here.
Yeah. Well, right. A, you want a reason for writing your article, and B, like, it's that Mighty Ducks kind of thing, you know, like at a certain point you're going like, oh, but I want to believe in that underdog. Like, I want them to succeed.
You don't want to write the headline that said you're still going to get old and die, or you're still going to get old probably and die definitely. That's not a headline you want to.
Right.
I don't know. I want to. Can we talk to Allison? Can we?
I think we can
write
pitch
an article.
How stuff works
yeah,
now.
Yeah. Okay. Like, let's do it.
Let's do a title where you're still going to get old probably and die definitely. So let's talk about the pro anti-aging side a little bit. So the SENS response to those criticisms is varied, but a frequent argument is that the critics of SENS, they say the people who are criticizing us are creating a straw man argument.
I know one thing I have encountered in seeing some of the pro-SENS people is they say our critics are sort of treating it as if we are making claims that we haven't made yet. You know, they might say that, you know, we're simply saying these avenues of research should be open and people should consider them legitimate. Whereas our opponents treat us as if we say we found the cure for aging.
To be fair, though, DeGray has been pretty adamant about these are avenues are the things that are going to lead us to anti-aging. Like, it's not.
Well, again, it's the headline.
Yeah. But it's making a claim.
Sure.
That's the problem.
Well, you're saying, like, yeah, he's got. He's got seven engineering problems that he thinks should be addressed.
Right. And his argument is that once we address these, we will have defeated aging. And that's. Some of the critics, at least, are saying that fundamental premise is flawed.
Yeah.
At any rate,
seems like a fair criticism.
Yeah. DeGray has often said that critics are arguing that it would be difficult, if not impossible, to treat all the effects of aging because we don't fully understand him, but they reject this argument. One of the arguments tends to be, at least DeGray has projected this as being an argument against him. I'm not sure where he pulled it up from, but one of the things I've seen him say is that a lot of people say, hey, for millions of years, animals have aged and grown more frail over time and eventually, if nothing else kills them, have died as a result of this. That's evolution that's happened for millions of years. It's going to take time to counteract that. And his response is, no, it won't. So because he says, like, well, look at how gene therapy, for example, could potentially counteract something that has been in development for millions of years.
Yeah.
And he says that shows that that's really a non-factor.
How long it's been around is not an issue. If somebody made that argument, they'd be wrong.
Yeah. Okay. The question is that really the argument that's being made against him, or is that just an argument he can win and therefore he presents that as his counterpoint?
Yeah.
There's a site called Fight Aging, which I went and read quite a few pieces on. I guess you can guess what
is it belligerent?
I wouldn't say belligerent.
Fight.
Definitely pro on the DeGray and SENS side of
things.
Is it
like Fight Club?
No, they want you to talk about it.
If it's your first time there, you have to age.
You have to stop aging. So a post from 2008 argues that, quote, the causes of aging are not the pathologies of aging. Pathologies are end results, end quote, which seemed really confusing to me at first because pathology is defined as the science of the causes and effects of diseases. So saying that the cause of aging is not the pathology of aging seems like you're kind of being...
The causes of aging are not the causes of aging.
Right.
Well, yeah, that sounds like maybe what they meant to say is the causes of aging are not the effects of aging.
Yeah, that's what I'm... When he's saying pathologies of aging, I think he's talking about the pathologies of age-related illnesses and conditions as opposed to aging itself. So the post appears to argue that these pathologies in question are those various diseases and conditions that are a result of aging, and that by addressing aging itself rather than treating the diseases, we could slow or even reverse the aging process. So in other words, the big argument here is saying, yes, the effects of aging are complicated, right? These diseases that are a result of the aging process are hard to understand. They will be difficult to treat. I'm not suggesting you do that. Instead, I'm suggesting you go back a step further up the chain and address the underlying conditions that lead to these diseases, and therefore you never have to treat the diseases anyway because you've stopped the dominoes before they can, you know, tilt over and cause everything to fall down.
Sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, I do hypothetically agree that the best way to prevent dominoes from falling is to never have dominoes in the first place.
Yeah, I'm much more of a Pizza Hut guy myself.
I think the real solution to aging is never be born.
Oh.
Think about it.
All right. Well, that same piece goes on to argue that there are comparatively few types of biochemical damage that can lead to the various age-related diseases. Now, this is the argument that is being presented in Fight Aging. And that by addressing the root cause of the biochemical damage, the diseases could be prevented in the first place, and you don't need to have any further understanding of the diseases. Whether or not we have the true understanding of that biochemical damage is another question.
Well, yeah, and that's the sticking point.
Yeah.
I agree that you don't need to understand how a disease happens in order to prevent it, but...
Yeah, you got to at least have identified the thing that sets everything off. Right. Like if I don't know, if I have a big meal, here's a great example. If I have a big meal and then 2 hours later I have a massive allergic reaction, I don't necessarily know what element of that big meal was the thing that set it off.
Uh-huh.
So without further experimentation and study, I could either just completely ignore everything that I ate and just never have it again. Or I could go another route and try and identify that thing so that can still enjoy all the other delicious things.
And you don't need to know how an allergic reaction works in order to prevent it in the future.
Right.
Like as long as you can identify
that
lobster.
Trigger. Yeah. Yeah. Or the shrimp, as the case may be.
Yeah.
So in February 2016, there was a debate titled "Lifespans Are Long Enough." That was the premise of the debate.
Mm-hmm.
So you had the pro side of the argument. So that's the group that says, yes, lifespans are long enough. We don't need to extend them anymore. They had Ian Ground of the University of Newcastle and Paul Root Wolpe from the Emory Center for Ethics. On the against side, as in, no, lifespans are not long enough, they had Aubrey de Grey and Brian Kennedy, who is the CEO of the Buck Institute for Research on Aging. So before the debate, 32% of the audience believed lifespans are long enough, 36% disagreed and said, no, they're not, and 32% said, I don't know. So then after the debate, 40% believed lifespans are long enough, 49% said, no, they totally are not, and 11% were like, I still don't know. So the online poll version was different. The online poll was dramatically in favor of de Grey's side, with 89% agreeing with the against position and only 11% agreeing on the for position.
Oh, it makes sense. I mean, I think people are way more eager to beg for more life when they're anonymous. When somebody knows who you are, you want to have the bravado of saying, like, yeah, I'll die whenever. But then once nobody knows who you are, it's like, oh, God, no.
Yeah, it's also a question of, like... would there have been more of de Grey's supporters tuning in?
On the internet, yeah.
Because of an emotional buy-in on the part of his position, which honestly I don't know the answers to.
Well, I mean, I'm not super swayed by audience opinions in any case on this, because obviously there could quite easily be some motivated reasoning going on. Actually, I would say on both sides.
I mean,
so the obvious side is that people want to live longer. I mean, you have some motivation to say, yes, this is possible because you want it. But then again, I brought up earlier how there might be a taboo on this subject, and I don't think that's an unfair assumption. I think very well be a taboo people have about the idea of monkeying too much with how long people live. Isn't it just supposed to be this way?
Yeah, I think that even if it's not something that anyone is thinking of, presently in the front of their mind while they're making these types of arguments and having these types of debates. It is probably something that's lurking in their psyche somewhere.
Yeah, sure. It seems unnatural.
Now, one thing that I think did help DeGray's argument quite a bit, and we can talk about this a little bit more, is...
Did he give them candy?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay.
Maybe he gave them a now and later and said, hey, if you want to be able to enjoy this now and later to the full extent, you won't have an extended lifespan. So you can enjoy some now and some later.
He gave them one marshmallow and said, if you can wait 500 years to eat this marshmallow, you'll get two.
I like our references to various psychological studies. No, what he said was that the research into trying to defeat aging will also lead to treatments and therapies for age-related diseases. And so there could be benefits, even if for some reason the SENS approach were to never actually bear fruit as far as defeating aging or reversing aging or increasing the health span that we would experience. He argued that they might learn more about ways to treat diseases like Alzheimer's.
Well, I mean, I think in my non-scientist's opinion, that's very possibly true.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's and you know, you can't understate that, right? That's a very valuable aspect.
Oh, sure. Well, and that's, again, I think we mentioned this in the last episode, but that's a thing that we talk about on the show all the time, is that the value of doing scientific research isn't always necessarily the thing that you set out to discover. It could very well be a wonderful side effect, mm-hmm. like x-rays.
Yeah. Yeah. Or finding a new treatment for Alzheimer's disease would be
right.
phenomenal, or Parkinson's or anything along those lines, where your initial research might have been in a related field. It might have been something that was trying to find a specific aspect of aging. And perhaps you never were able to nail that down, but you might have learned something along the way of dealing with like a neurological illness or anything along those lines.
You know, I wonder if there's any reason you can think of why we shouldn't do this. Why, let's say we could discover a path to healthy aging that would extend human lifespan by a long, long time. Is there an argument you could make that that's not okay? That that's a thing we shouldn't allow ourselves to do?
Well, ethically and morally, I think sure.
There's some
what
questions.
Is it?
Like for instance, there's the argument that has been made that when you start increasing lifespans, that you may also see a decrease in offspring. In other words, you might end up seeing an increasingly ageless population that's never changing. It's not getting any circulation there. There's a decrease in the number of children being born, and that it could therefore become stagnant. That to me sounds almost like you're taking this idea and projecting it using almost like a science fiction sort of approach without necessarily having the scientific evidence to back up that claim. But it's something I've seen a lot of.
On the flip side of that, what if the population growth rate doesn't slow?
Right.
What if you have the population growing and overpopulating at such an incredible rate? You know, we already have many problems with overpopulation and getting resources to where they need to be to support that population. Would it be responsible to allow people to live longer?
Or who would have access to it?
Oh, right.
Because
sure.
if it's only the people who make a certain amount of money, mm-hmm. then you have not the one percenters become not just the people who hold most of the wealth. They're the ones who will live long after you're gone. And just not fair.
I think a lot of these things that we bring up play on the idea of unfairness. You know, there seems like that there could be situations of unfairness. But it seems in those cases that the unfairness would be to the people who don't get access to the procedure.
Right.
And I'm wondering if is the answer then that nobody should have it? Like, is it better to make everybody be punished?
I certainly can't speak philosophically, morally, ethically to this, but I would assume that there is a point of view out there that kind of tinkering with human life goes against the purpose of humans, like whatever creator purpose exists for us in the universe.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of people would have various religious objections and so forth.
Sure, you know, sure.
One weird unfairness that comes to my mind is like back projected historical unfairness. There's nothing to do about this, but I have this thought of like, well, what if we did have the ability to live to 500? That would be so unfair to all the people who died before we had that.
What about FDR? Again,
right.
But won't anyone consider FDR?
There's actually a great Mitchell and Webb skit about this.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Where David Mitchell gets irrationally angry that the generation after him will be the first generation to live forever. And he is so angry that it's not his generation.
But yeah, then again, is this a reason we should like punish the people who exist today? Well,
according to David Mitchell, it absolutely is.
Yeah.
But again, that was a comedy sketch. But I think
that's just sort of a weird intuition. But yeah, it does seem like, man, it sucks for like the last person dying in a hospital bed of old age before this becomes available.
Well, that's gonna happen.
I'm mad at the last person to get through a light before it turns red. Like, I'm gonna be furious at people who get to live longer than
me. In Atlanta, come on, three people can go through that red light. So, I was going to say that I think a lot of the people who object to the anti-aging, you know, approach, the SENS approach specifically, don't object to the research or the lines of inquiry or any of that. What they object to is the presentation, the fact that it is being presented in an ostentatious manner, as if the conclusion has already – the conclusion's proven. We're just waiting for the results to have the formalities addressed. That, I think, is where a lot of people have the real objection, is that that this guy claims to have the answers already. He now he's looking for the scientific backing to prove that the answers he has – are all valid answers, and that's not the way science is supposed to work. And I think that's the major objection. Some of them have said, hey, it may turn out that some of the things he's claimed are absolutely correct, but we have no way of knowing that, and he has no way of knowing that. So I could just as easily claim the color blue is what causes aging.
Give me money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that I think is where the major objection is. Not so much that we should not look into ways to treat or halt or reverse aging.
And not that it's impossible. Right.
Right. Rather, we can't just make a claim and then hope that we can back it up. That, I think, is where most of the objections I've seen come from.
Sure. I don't know. Like, and I do get it, you know, watching it. And if you guys out there have not ever watched Aubrey de Grey speak, I totally recommend checking it out, because he's a very entertaining speaker, if nothing else.
And he has an epic beard.
So epic. Maybe he's using all the research money to just moisturize his beard.
Yes,
maybe
just,
that's
just
what's going on.
All going to beard oil.
That's terrible. I'm sorry. No. So,
he is the Rasputin of gerontology.
Yeah. Yeah. We have made this assertion before. We will make it again.
No. What I was trying to get in to say is that even if you disagree with Sens and with Aubrey de Grey's personal ideas, I think it's wonderful that he is encouraging this kind of discussion, and that he is promoting the concept of doing this research. I mean,
I don't necessarily agree with the methodology, but it certainly has. And I think one of the reasons I don't agree with the methodology is I think that because it has created such a reactionary response that it somewhat delays any results we might see otherwise. But at least there's a conversation happening.
Right.
And that is good. And whether or not we as members of the media are helping or hindering that kind of is still up for debate, I guess, depending upon what side of the argument you fall on. But it is absolutely fascinating. And of course, this is something that affects all of us. So,
yeah. Yeah. And, you know, we shouldn't let de Grey's style of optimism overpower our reasoning, but we also shouldn't let our reasoning overpower our optimism.
I agree. I've always said that optimism to me includes acknowledging the challenges that are in the way, but not allowing those challenges to prevent us from trying, right? There needs to be that balance there. You need to be able to say, this is what I'm setting out to do. I know there are going to be road bumps on the way. I am willing and able to overcome those as I encounter them. And that to me that's kind of the human story in many ways. Hasn't always been a pleasant one, but it's been throughout the ages really inspiring to see what people can do, particularly when they don't know that something is impossible, because it turns out they push back that definition of what impossible actually is. So this was kind of cool. It was interesting and, again, a more philosophical discussion than what we sometimes will talk about here on the show. If you guys have suggestions for future episodes of Forward Thinking, let us know. Or if you have thoughts about this whole topic, I want to hear what you have to say. Send us an email. Our address is fwthinking@howstuffworks.com, or drop us a line on Twitter or Facebook. At Twitter, we are fwthinking. If you search FW Thinking in Facebook, our profile will pop right up. You can leave us a message there, and we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.
It's brand new season 2. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf at Adam. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to brand new on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing. This week, I'm talking to the one and only Ryan Seacrest.
Love the connection to people. I think at the core, what I get excited about, what gets me up in the morning, is connecting with people in an unscripted, unvarnished way. Is getting to say something to them, hear back from them, know that I'm part of the routine, and I look forward to getting on the air. I look forward to it.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
Let's take a moment to breathe. Deep inhale. Extend your spine. Remain focused on what you're doing. If safe to do so, exhale slowly, leaning to one side. Inhale back to center. If safe to do so, exhale slowly to the opposite side. Find mental health resources at loveyourmindtoday.org. This message is brought to you by the Huntsman Mental Health Institute and the Ed Council.